Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Lowy Institute. I'm Michael Fullilove, the director of the Institute. We're in the middle of a federal election campaign. I'm afraid we don't have any democracy sausages here today, but we do have some sandwiches, and I hope you've had something to eat. I can't say that the issues that the Institute concerns itself with have featured very much in the campaign. When the PM was shearing a sheep the other day, it wasn't at an event about Australia's livestock trade, for example. We've heard some peripheral discussion of issues that will affect Australia's role in the world, whether it's climate change or refugees or the Republic. But there has been very little discussion of Australia's international policies as such. But that doesn't deter the Institute, and we are working hard to illuminate these questions. This afternoon, we will release a terrific digital feature where you can go on the feature, look at a range of international issues and see, first of all, what the two parties say and, secondly, what our experts say. So please have a look at that. We've been pleased to host the Foreign Minister, Senator Payne, twice in the past few months, and we've been honoured to do that. And tomorrow I'm pleased to say we're hosting the Shadow Foreign Minister, Senator Penny Wong, for the first time in about 2 years. And today we're going to show off some of the Institute's expertise on the international issues facing Australia. We have a terrific panel, as always. Alex Oliver, to my left, is our Director of Research with responsibility for all of the Institute's research output. She's an expert on polling. Alex ran the Lowy Institute poll for the last few years until this year, and her expertise is also in areas like diplomacy and consular affairs and other issues. Anne-Marie O'Keefe is a non-resident fellow in the Institute's Pacific Islands program. She previously served as a Deputy Director General of AusAid, when that was a separate agency, as well as Australia's ambassador to Nepal. Sam Roggeveen is the Director of the Institute's International Security Program. Many of you know Sam as the founding editor of the Institute's terrific digital magazine, The Interpreter. Before joining the Institute, he served as a senior strategic analyst at the Office of National Assessments in Canberra. And on the end of the panel, we have Richard McGregor, a senior fellow at the Institute for the past year or so, in which time he's quickly established himself, in my judgment, as Australia's leading China expert. Before joining us, he spent 9 years as the Financial Times bureau chief in Shanghai and Beijing, and he spent 4 years for the FT in Washington. And earlier in his career, he was a highly respected member of the Canberra Press Gallery. So, welcome, ladies and gentlemen. I'm going to start off by giving each of the panelists 2 minutes, which I'm going to police very sternly, 2 minutes to talk about the government and the opposition in their area of expertise. So I might start with you, Richard, on China, if you don't mind.
Right. So with China, in theory, we had a reset of our relations in China last November. There was a meeting in Beijing. I was at that meeting, Track 2, it's called, an Australian delegation, a Chinese delegation, the Australian delegation led by John Howard and Stephen Smith. It was bipartisan. But as anybody can see from what's happened in the 5 or 6 months since then, it's been a reset, but at a pretty lukewarm level. We've still got sort of trade issues, economic issues of economic coercion. The same geopolitical tensions remain. Whomever takes over, it's going to come with those inbuilt tensions. Huawei, we might have think we've taken the decision, but China would love to put pressure on us to revisit that. They're having some success in the UK. China thinks it's having some success on Huawei in New Zealand, possibly. So we might be very isolated on that issue. The South China Sea will remain a point of tension, and to some extent the Pacific setup, a step up. And finally, of course, we passed laws last year on foreign interference and the like, and that also could be a source of tension because we could have, you know, Chinese Australians in Australian courts being asked about their ties to the Communist Party. So I think whatever happens, you know, Labor believes, and let's, assuming Labor wins, I'm not assuming that, but for the point of this answer, Labor believes that, and you've heard Bill Shorten talk about this, that the relationship through a series of sort of disciplined, measured initiatives, you can rebuild a level of trust and dialogue with China. And over time, you can get the relationship up to a reasonable level. We'll see about that. Given all the sort of geopolitical tensions, US, China, that won't go away. Finally, trade. We are likely, not certain, to get some kind of US-China trade deal. That might hurt third countries like Australia in areas of agricultural produce, LNG and the like. And so there's going to be a spillover, I think, of trade tensions in ways which benefit us and potentially hurt us, but at their base are starting to corrode the global trading system, the WTO and the like, which is certainly not in our interests either.
Terrific. Sam, what about on defence? How do you see the two sides?
As you'll see, thank you, Michael. As you'll see in the digital feature that we're releasing this afternoon, the contribution I made will say that there is a great deal of consensus between the two major parties on defence policy. Both are committed to...
Sam, let me ask you to use your mic.
Sorry. Thank you. Increasing spending to 2% of GDP by 2020-21. So just a few years from now. And I think that reflects heightened concern across the political spectrum about the rise of China. We saw that concern reflected in the defence white paper in 2016, the foreign policy white paper in 2017. More recently, you've had our political leaders, including the Prime Minister Scott Morrison, say that that the United States and China are entering a period of increased strategic competition. So there's clear concern about that. I think that explains why both sides are agreed on spending more on defence. Unfortunately, what they are both also agreed on is in doing that spending in, I think, the least effective ways. So there is a tendency to... there has been a tendency in this government for defence policy to become effectively a subset of economic policy, particularly on shipbuilding. So we're insisting on building all 12 of these new French submarines, a $50 billion contract, building them in Adelaide. We're building 9 expensive new frigates, $35 billion contract. We're building those in Australia as well. Just yesterday, the Prime Minister announced that 2 mine warfare vessels and a hydrographic ship would be built in Perth. And in fact, that decision seems to have been brought forward significantly. There was no indication in the white paper that Australia would need these new ships. In fact, there was talk about extending the life of the existing ones. It's really a case of economic policy, I think, driving defence policy. And that suggests to me that even though China is a strategic driver, the rise of China is a strategic driver for our defence policy, our political class hasn't yet fully internalised the idea that China is a massive new, a growing presence in our strategic space. And also that the Americans may not be there for very much longer, at least in the terms that they are now, to help us manage that threat.
Very good. Anne-Marie, there seems to be a lot of consensus between the parties on the Pacific and the need to step up in the Pacific, although less consensus, I think, on the quantum of Australian aid. Do you think that's a fair comment?
Yeah, I think aid is one of those areas where there's very limited bipartisan agreement. If we look at what's happened to the aid budget under the coalition government, it's now at the lowest level ever, and that's ever. So you can see that the coalition government has been quite determined to bring the amount of funding spent on the developing world to a very, very low level. At the same time, it particularly last November, when Prime Minister Scott Morrison made the announcement about the re-engagement, if you like, with the Pacific, the latest coalition budget in April has as headlines a significant amount dedicated to the Pacific as a proportion of the budget. Now, for those of you who know how to read an aid budget, be my guest, try and work that out. But if you're interested, I can take you through the lights and mirrors approach to that $1.4 billion. It's a difficult one to actually track. On the other hand, what will happen if a coalition government comes back? We have no idea, because there's nothing on record in terms of what a coalition government would want to do with the aid budget in the future. But we can assume, given past practice, that it'll be more of the same. On the other hand, the Labor Party has made it very clear that they intend to increase the aid budget every year while they are in power. There's a certain formula that they will use, which I won't raise here. But there has been an absolute clear statement by the Labor Party that the aid budget will increase. And Penny Wong has also made it clear that there would be an emphasis on rebuilding Australia's development expertise, which was rather scuttled with the abolition of AusAid and the merging of functions into DFAT, which happened under an Abbott government. So there you can see quite a divergence. In terms of the Pacific, Shorten himself, in response to the Morrison speech, also made it clear that the Pacific would be a core priority, his words, not mine, of an incoming Labor government. How that will work out, we have no idea because there is no detail behind that statement. But it's quite probable, quite possible, that they will adopt what was set out in the 2017 White Policy Paper.
Thank you. Finally, Alex, what about the diplomatic footprint, which is an issue the Institute has been talking about for a long time?
Yes, we have, ever since we did a study on this in 2009, and talking about foreign policy issues which get no attention at election time or even at budget time. Our diplomacy is a spectacular example of bipartisan neglect. There's a complete lack of public interest in it. It's not something that generates votes. Money for diplomats is never a big winner. But I think what most average voters don't realise is that Australia has an extraordinarily small diplomatic network for a country of its economic size and wealth. It has one of the smallest diplomatic networks in the developed world. It ranks behind Belgium, Hungary, Portugal, Chile and Greece, obviously all much smaller nations than Australia and with populations a fraction of the size, for example, Belgium with 11 million. We ranked in 2017 in this longitudinal study that we've been doing on Australia's diplomatic network, Australia at 28th of 60 G20, OECD and Asian nations. We have around 118 posts worldwide. We have embassies in approximately 80 countries. There are 200 nations, members of the United Nations, so that gives you an idea of where we don't cover. For a country of Australia's size, but also importantly our geographic and geopolitical situation, we're globally engaged, we're geographically distant from our largest trading partner, our largest security partner, and so diplomacy is exceptionally important for a country that is geopolitically situated as Australia is. And this is something we've been arguing now for the last decade. I talked about bipartisan neglect. Since 2013, the coalition has actually made a pretty good effort at increasing our diplomatic footprint. They've added 8 new posts, which has increased the size by about 7%. But it's nowhere near enough. So if Australia's 118 posts were to come up to just the OECD average, and that's not even the G20 average, of course we're a member of the G20 as well, we'd have to add another 15 or 20 posts to come anywhere near. But it's a bigger problem than just that, because not only do we have a small number of posts, but the staffing of those posts is also very thin. We have fewer diplomats now, and this is astonishing. Abroad, there are only about 800. I think we think of there being this great host of diplomats going and drinking lots of cocktails at functions around the world, but in fact we only have just around 800 of them, and that's fewer than we had 30 years ago. So for a country that's grown the size that we have, we've doubled in size, we've doubled in our economic weight, and yet we have fewer diplomats now than we had back then. That's unacceptable. I think it needs to change.
Excellent. Now, before I've got some other questions to ask the colleagues, but before I do that, I'm going to have a little editorial too, seeing as everybody else has had a chance. And I thought what I might do is go up a little bit in altitude and talk a bit about the parties and the personalities, because I think those two elements matter a lot in the shape and the character of the government that's formed after the election. In terms of the parties, I think we can draw some generalisations. Coalition governments tend to be more focused on bilateral relationships, and Labor governments tend to be more multilateral in their worldviews. Coalition governments tend to look at the world a bit more through the prism of the US alliance. Labor governments tend to have a bit more skepticism about America's leadership role. On Asia, both parties have prioritized the region at different times, but I think that engagement with China is more strongly encoded, I would say, in Labor's DNA probably than the coalition's, although nobody should tell Andrew Robb that I said that. The coalition has a stronger record on defence spending, but Labor, as Anne-Marie has pointed out, have a stronger record on aid spending. In terms of the personalities, it's worth thinking about the remarkable churn that we have gone through in the past decades. We've had 5 prime ministers in the past 6 years, and if Mr. Shorten is elected next month, we will have had 6 prime ministers in 6 years. No prime minister has served a full term since 2007. And I think in that same period, it's fair to say that Australian foreign policy has lost its shape. It's lost momentum and it's lost ambition. And no wonder, because the turnover of the leaders who are elected to and entrusted with formulating that policy and implementing it have moved on so quickly. So if you consider Mr. Turnbull, for example, after a couple of years in the post, he was putting the pieces together. He had come up with a framework for dealing with, for his approach to China, for example, Southeast Asia, and then he was gone. And so I think the churn matters. Now, thinking about the personalities we have on both sides, in terms of Mr. Morrison, he's been in office for about 9 months. I might ask whoever that person is to turn their phone off if you don't mind. He's been in office for about 9 months. I think he's carried out his duties professionally. But of course, he has been distracted by problems within his party and by this looming election. And the nature of the churn has affected the way he's conducted his business internationally. When he went in summit season, for example, you recall that Chancellor Merkel needed a headshot of her interlocutor for her meeting with Mr. Morrison. You remember that Mr. Trump's first question to Mr. Morrison in their one-on-one, their first meeting, was what happened to Malcolm? So you can see that this churn has real-world effects to how these people conduct themselves and the relationships they can develop. Senator Payne, I would say, is professional. She's attentive to the issues. She is very cautious, and it's hard to think of any new initiatives that have surfaced in her time as foreign minister. Christopher Pyne has been a breath of fresh air in defence. He's energetic, he's enthusiastic, and he's decisive, and he's also leaving. On the opposition side, Mr. Shorten has not focused much on the world. He gave a very good speech to the Institute in October. Whereas Mr. Morrison's speeches on foreign policy have emphasised values, Mr. Shorten has tended to emphasise independence and confidence and ambition as themes. He promised at the Institute, he promised a foreign policy with an Australian accent. To the extent that he lifts his eyes to the horizon, it tends to be the near horizon. So some of you might have seen on over the weekend, he gave an interview in which he said he wanted his first international visits as PM to be to New Zealand, Papua New Guinea, Timor-Leste and Indonesia. He was, of course, very critical of Mr. Trump in 2016, saying that he was barking mad. I asked him about that last year. I said, how would you deal with Mr. Trump? And he responded professionally. So that would be a relationship to watch because Mr. Trump takes names, as we know. Just thinking finally of Labor's team, they've been in their posts for a fair amount of time, so they've had a chance to get comfortable. Senator Wong would be, I think, an intellectual foreign minister. She's a skeptic by nature. She reads a lot. She's a forensic questioner. In estimates. Mr. Miles is a traditional figure from the Labor right. He's very big on the US alliance, very hawkish on China, very keen on the Pacific. On the biggest question facing Australia, and I'll end on this, on the US-China-Australia relationship, it's actually a bit hard to say on where either party would come down. And the reason I say that is this. On the coalition side, Mr. Morrison inherited hawkish policy settings from the Turnbull era because that's where Turnbull ended up in his Shangri-La dialogue speech on the foreign interference laws, on the Huawei call, on other sorts of issues. But it's hard really to see either Mr. Morrison or Senator Payne as China hawks. They've done nothing in their time in office to complicate the China relationship. If anything, they've tried to smooth it over. Neither of them are very ideological figures. So if they were if the government were re-elected, we don't know really whether you'd get a toughening of China policy as we saw under Mr. Turnbull as they're in office for longer or not, or if this is the settling point actually for the coalition. On the Labor side, we don't know because there are important figures in the caucus on both sides of the debate. There are figures, as I said, like Mr. Miles, who are pretty orthodox on the role of the US alliance, for example. And then there are others like Mr. Bowen and others who are who I would say put more of a premium on taking a positive approach to China, who are probably influenced. There's a number of Labor Party grandees, including Mr. Keating and so on, who would want a Labor government to take a more positive view on China and to create a bit more space between Canberra and Washington. So we don't really know how they would fall down. I think we can say that for either side, the China dilemma of this giant country to our north, our largest trading partner by a country mile, run by a Leninist political party that brooks no interference in Chinese internal affairs, this is a significant foreign policy issue, and the most significant foreign policy issue we've faced in decades. And as Sam says, it's hard to see really to squint your eyes at the political class and to say that they have fully internalized that. And I think for a government of either on the coalition makeup or on the Labor side, that will be the question. Is either side up to the tough long-term challenge of saying no to China when our interests require us to do so, as they surely will? So that's my little say on the parties and the personalities and that big issue of US-China. I've got some more specific questions for the panel, but before I do, let me invite them if they'd like to comment on anything I've said. I don't know, Richard, if you have any views on those sort of thematic questions.
Well, one thing that did occur to me, we're using the word professional a lot today. You know, so-and-so is a professional. I feel like that's damning with faint praise, frankly. It's like they execute the DFAT brief. And I think that tells you a lot about this election, actually, that, you know, I watched the debate last night. I did manage to find it on 7-2, which I hadn't heard of before. There's not a single word about foreign policy in that. There was quite an interesting article which captured this in the Australian Financial Review recently. I think actually most the political class, whatever that means, I'm not sure I like that expression, but I think, you know, the professional class, there's that word again, who are meant to deal with Australia's strategic circumstances, they're gripped by the issue of US-China and China, but really nobody knows what to do and there's no clear roadmap ahead. And we're not discussing it at all in the election. Now, there's another way of looking at that, of course, and that is that you don't want to have too much of a high decibel debate because it can run off the rails. And I think the approach of maybe Morrison Payne at the moment, and maybe the new government coming in with China in some respects, would be do more, say less. Whether you can carry that off in a democracy, we'll see. But I think whoever handles China now is going to have to be very disciplined about it.
Does anyone else want to chime in at this point, or Alex?
Well, just a corollary of the prime ministerial churn that you spoke about, 5 prime ministers in 6 years, is ministerial churn, and we've seen a lot of foreign ministers come and go as well. Just looking back since the Hawke years, since 2007, we've had 5 foreign ministers in 12 years. In the period before that, between 1983 and 2007, we had 3 ministers. Alexander Downer served for 11 and 3/4 years, so 1 foreign minister. We've had 5 over that same period. And this makes a difference, I think, because diplomacy is about relationships. When we have a churn of leaders, at least most Australians know who Scott Morrison is, but if they need a picture in a briefing pack for Angela Merkel, then they certainly do for a new foreign minister, and we're headed for another new one. So I would just hope that that the foreign minister at least does what Julie Bishop did and lasted for 5.5 years and probably was better known than some of her prime ministerial leaders. And one of the things I would hope from a foreign minister is to advocate for their department, because that has been something that has been missing. And I mentioned the issue of diplomatic networks and our diplomatic so-called deficit. One of the things that foreign ministers haven't done is advocate for their department. They haven't advocated for the aid budget. And when you look at the size of the defence budget, for example, we spend $30 billion per annum on defence. We've just signed a $50 billion contract for submarines. And we spend somewhere between $1.5 and $2 billion on our diplomacy. The contrast is very stark. Alexander Downer always wore it as a badge of honour that he didn't want to ask for money for his department and that he could do more with less. And we've been asking our Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade to do more with less. They do more with less aid. They do more with less in terms of diplomacy. And I would hope that the next foreign minister would actually have the courage to stand up and say diplomacy needs to be funded.
Let me ask you, Alex, another question about diplomacy and DFAT, and that is the phenomenon of political appointments to diplomatic posts. This has always been a feature of Australian politics, where governments appoint their friends and sometimes their enemies to embassies in order to create a vacancy, usually for a new minister or a new MP, or to take care of a troublesome internal critic, as Mr. Turnbull tried to do with Mr. Abbott a couple of times in London, I think. So it's always been a feature, but it does seem to have accelerated, and there's a lot of them at the moment. And these postings also seem to be happening to posts that previously were never occupied by, or very rarely occupied by, a politician. So what do you make of that?
Well, I did have a look at it. We've been doing some work on this on another research project. Of course, there have been a lot of political appointments, not just diplomatic appointments, in the last few months. Everybody has noticed, whether they be to the judiciary or the administrative appeals tribunal. But in the diplomatic area, we've had four since January. That's to the OECD. That was also a political appointment before. San Francisco, a lot of political appointments in the United States, unsurprisingly, in nice places. Chicago, and as you say, Michael, in New Zealand, and that's surprising. There's a businesswoman and business leader has been appointed there in a post that has traditionally been a career diplomatic appointment. Just looking back over history again, I went back to the Hawke government, where there were a couple of notable appointments, and as there was under John Howard, who appointed Robert Hill to the UN and Amanda Vanstone to Rome. But since then, it's accelerated. There were three under the first Rudd government: Brendan Nelson, Kim Beazley, Phil Scannon. Under the Gillard government, there were five, and one, notoriously Steve Brax, was undone by the incoming Abbott government. Mike Rann, John McCarthy to the Vatican, Brendan Nelson, a couple of other political appointments. Under Tony Abbott, the trend continued. Of course, there was Alexander Downer sent off to the UK, and Nick Minchin to New York. And then there were a slew of them under Malcolm Turnbull. There were nine that I counted: George Brandis, Peter McGoran, Craig Knowles, Chris Barnes, Alasdair Walton, Richard Court, Sharman Stone, Joe Hockey, of course, very political in the change of leadership there. So, yes, it has accelerated. And I think there are some, and I know you agree, Michael, there are some posts where political appointees are very useful. And one could argue that in the United States, for example, in Washington now, Joe Hockey is a useful political appointment in that it's sort of he's the sort of character that can make a connection with a very political creature like Donald Trump. Some of those appointments in the United States have traditionally been political appointments, and there's a real case to be made for those. But there are others where those positions should be led by career diplomats who have those diplomatic skills to make those relationships run very smoothly. So I think it is of concern, this acceleration.
All right. Anne-Marie, let me ask you another question to do with DFAT, and that is, you mentioned in your opening remarks the amalgamation of DFAT and AusAid and some deleterious effects that had come out of that. So if the coalition is re-elected, we're not going to be very unlikely to see them trying to undo that. But if Labor is elected, is that something that they should think about unpicking? Is it too late to unpick? What's your judgment of what the impact of that decision has been, and what could be done if not reversing it? What could be done to try to reverse some of the negative effects?
There are a few issues that come to light in that. It's 5 years since AusAid was abolished, and in those 5 years, there have been some, I think, significant improvements within the developing world. I think it's very important, before thinking about what the architecture of aid is for Australia, you actually have to look at what is it that you want your aid program to do. And once you've worked out what you want your aid program to do, what is the best way of implementing it? And I think, you know, if a Labor government comes to power, a Labor Party comes to power, that should be their first question. What is it that we want our aid program to do? Now, in terms of extreme poverty, there have been significant advances in eradication of poverty to the point now that it's about less than 3% in the Asia region where you will find people in extreme poverty. I mean, that's an extraordinary advance if you think of what was happening in 1990 when 60% of the world's extreme poor lived in Asia. Well, that's no longer the case. So we need to be looking at that. We need to be looking at the shifting boundaries of poverty found more and more in middle-income countries. We need to be looking at the big challenges facing those countries which have still got, if you like, immature economies or emerging economies. So what is it that an aid program can do for them? Now, by having merged those sorts of approaches and activities within foreign affairs, it has diminished, I think, even further, the capacity of the traditional diplomat, if you like. They're already stretched, and now they have to take on another really complex set of tasks to implement an effective aid program in a very changing world. You've got new development partners coming in. China, of course, is a very big one, and that's another issue in terms of Australia and the Pacific and China. But you've also got the other non-traditionals, such as the philanthropic organisations, etc., etc., and the private sector, very important in actually being the engine of economic growth in these countries. So I think the way forward is to first identify what it is that you want to achieve and where it is you need to be spending your money. What sort of skills and expertise do you require? And then trying to address the tension, the natural tensions you're going to be getting within the portfolio of foreign affairs, where on one hand you've got the short-term initiatives or short-term imperatives for diplomacy and using aid to address those versus the long-term nature of development. Development takes a really long time. It's very slow. It's not a particularly effective diplomatic tool. And that's where your tensions come in. And that's where you're finding with heads of mission charged with running aid programs, as well as everything else they've got to run, you are finding that Australian aid is less and less effective. So, yes, you have to work out what you want, where you want it, and what sort of mechanism is best to serve you.
Okay. I'm going to ask one more question of the panel, and then I'm going to go to the audience, and I might come back later and ask some other questions. Sam, Alex mentioned the subs decision that the Australian government took to build a new fleet of highly lethal, highly effective submarines, provided by the French company Naval Group. There's been some criticism, naturally, of that decision, both on grounds of cost, but also on the grounds of the timing, because it's going to be waiting a long time until those boats are in the water. So this will be one of the first big decisions, really, for the Labor government. What do they do about this? I mean, if that's to say, if Labor is elected again, if the coalition is elected, you wouldn't expect a change, I don't think, on this, although we will have a change of defence minister. But if Labor is elected, given Labor's history on defence spending under the Rudd-Gillard period, where they made very few, if any, major capability decisions, where they pushed everything to the right, where the percentage of the rate of defence spending came down to very low levels, given that they're going to have other priorities, how do you think a Labor government would think about the subs decision? Do you think they would revisit it, hold the spolus? Would they look to modify it? What do you predict?
Well, let's first of all understand what these submarines mean for Australia. So these are our most important strategic asset. I talked in my previous answer about the rise of China and about the possibility that the United States over the long term might have a diminished place in the region and therefore, you know, would be less able to protect Australia in case of any kind of military confrontation or at least an attempt at military coercion. In those kind of circumstances, the submarines become even more important than they already are. These are our most important strategic asset. Nothing else that Australia has in its armoury can do what submarines can do against a major power adversary. What they say is that they're unique in our Defence Force capabilities. They give Australia the ability to say, if you try to hurt us or if you try to coerce us with military force, we can hurt you back. That's the only thing that we have in Australia that we can say that about. Now, clearly, both sides of politics feel agree that these submarines are important enough that they want to double the size of the fleet from 6 to 12. So then the question that is raised in my mind, if it's so important, why wait till 2035 for the first one? The growth of Chinese military capability that I talked about earlier is happening right now. In fact, the Institute for Strategic Studies in London said recently that just between 2014 and 2018, China built enough naval vessels to equal the tonnage of the entire French Navy. Right. That was just in the space of 4 years. And that expansion is still happening. So to go directly to your question, Michael, I wouldn't be at all surprised. First of all, Labor is committed to building all the submarines in Adelaide, just as the coalition is, but it's a very long contract. And also given the fact that Labor in opposition has not been privy to the classified briefings, I wouldn't be at all surprised if Labor wins office that after those briefings happen that we might see the Defence Minister launch a review. And perhaps the outcome of that review is that at least the first submarine is built offshore in France. I think that would be a good outcome. I'm not saying that's guaranteed because there'd be a political price to pay for Labor to do that. But at the very least, I think we might see the new Defence Minister launch a review.
Okay. Let me go to the audience and take a couple of questions and offer those to the panel if I can. So please, if you'd like to ask a question, raise your hand. Yes, sir.
Well, my question is mainly about foreign interference in election. So is Australia currently concerned with any foreign power that may directly manipulate the willingness of people, therefore the result of election? If there are, so who may that be? And in what ways do you think they may manipulate the willingness of training people?
Okay, good question. And we'll take another question from this lady in the same round.
My question is mainly about the Australian-Chinese relations, because we can see that the two countries share very close economic interests, and it's very hard to find some interest conflict between the two sides, but we can see that the relations experienced a lot of twists and turns in recent years. So my first question is, in your opinion, what is the most biggest problem rooted in the bilateral relations that make it experience so much twists and turns? And another question is that this lady just mentioned about the frequent change of the Australian government, the foreign ministers. Mm-hmm. So in your opinion, does this kind of frequent changes have some maybe influence to the development of the bilateral relations?
Okay, great. We might start with Richard on foreign interference and the biggest challenge in the bilateral relationship.
Well, certainly Australian authorities, the Electoral Commission, and also I think the ASD, the Signals Directorate, have said they're on the ready for any signs of foreign interference. That's one kind of, you know, that's formally entering into the electoral mechanism. On the other issue of foreign interference, there's some people have written about WeChat, the Chinese app. As far as I can see, the main users of WeChat are Australian politicians. And obviously the Chinese community. I think the Chinese community views within WeChat are pretty diverse. I mean, I'm not so fussed about that. I don't think it's a big factor. You know, Bennelong, Reed, Banks in Sydney, is that going to be a game changer? I doubt it. I think one of the very interesting things, if you look at policy on that issue, when what Labor announced and what did Labor announce to try and woo the so-called Chinese vote? And that was an extension of and change of visas for elderly Chinese people to be able to come in. In other words, grandparents to care for grandchildren. So, and I thought that's about the least offensive thing you could announce. On China-Australia, there's obviously a whole host of issues. You would have many Australians arguing on the interference issue that the Chinese really don't respect Australian sovereignty. They don't really respect the decision on Huawei. If you look at what China bans from, you know, as it has every right to do on a sovereign basis from China, you can get a laundry list of companies, Facebook, Twitter, Snapchat, even Instagram, all those sorts of things. They're all banned from China. But I think Wang Yi, the foreign minister, described the banning of Huawei as sort of unjust and immoral. So I think China is very unhappy about the Huawei decision. I think that will stay in their system for a while as a black mark against Australia. That's why I talked earlier about their desire to isolate Australia on that issue, because they don't want it to spread around the world. I think they're also very unhappy, and it will stay in the Chinese system for a long time because of the high decibel nature of the debate about China in Australia, which I also think they think has ramifications around the world. I personally think we're always going to have a relationship with tensions. We have to get it back to the point where the leaders of the country are talking to each other. And if you have a good relationship or a reasonable and frank relationship at the top, then many things under that can be handled. And of course, as we've mentioned today, we haven't been able to sustain that relationship. Maybe we should take a leaf out of Xi Jinping's book and have a Prime Minister for life for a few years, you know, get rid of term limits or something, and that way then they could have plenty of time to establish a relationship.
As always, it depends on which Prime Minister for life
we're
talking about.
Who
what
gets
about
to choose?
The final question that the lady asked about foreign ministers, and in particular, how do you think Penny Wong would approach the China relationship? Would it be different from the way, for example, that Ms. Bishop or Senator Payne have done it?
Yes, well, Penny, I think she's intellectually curious and cautious at the same time. I think one of the interesting issues about Penny Wong, and I think really Bill Shorten as well, actually, if we are going through an upheaval in our strategic circumstances and we have big decisions to take, they have to sell them. Now, we'll see how they go in office. Are they both natural political salesmen and women? I'm not so sure, actually. You've got to be charitable and give them time to find their feet. But, you know, we need people with great powers of persuasion, vision, and, of course, a reasonable majority in the parliament to be able to do all those things. And I think that's really the jury is out on that.
Hello, I'm Angela Bogdan, the Canadian Consul General here.
Hello.
And it's been really fascinating to listen to this. Canada's going to the polls later on this year, and many of the same big issues that you've touched on will be grappling with. I have two specific questions. If memory serves, the Lowy Institute produced a report several years ago called Addressing the Diplomatic Deficit. Excellent report, and in fact it informed a lot of Canada's thinking of how to re-energize and have a more effective diplomatic capability to extend our interests globally. So my question would be, based, Alex, on what you said, what happened?
Not enough.
Well, and you know, I think it's really important to address why, like, what actually did happen, because your issues or our issues are everyone's issues globally. Second point would be climate change. If I didn't hear a lot about that, and I wonder if you could comment on, is this an election issue for the average Australian?
Thank you. I'll take the question from the lady at the back as well.
Hello, my name is Anna Booth. I'm from New Zealand Trade and Enterprise. Can't help but think that in 15, 16 years, those 12 submarines might be obsolete, and that commercial sector may very well come up with other solutions that are going to be more effective than those submarines. Besides that sort of spending spree, is either the Coalition or the Labor Party, have they announced any sort of defence spending that might have a little bit more future-proofing for the defence sector?
Well, thank you. Let me just say, Consul General, welcome, and let me say that both Richard and I were very pleased to sign a petition recently in support of the two Canadians who've been detained wrongfully by China. I think it's important when that kind of behaviour occurs that all of us show solidarity with each other. So let me go to Alex, if I can, on the diplomatic deficit, and then come back to Sam on the question of future-proofing our Defence Force.
Thank you, Consul General. Yes, we wrote that report in 2009 and then we revisited it in 2011, and then rather than selling the same story again and again and again, we decided to put those diplomatic networks on a map in 2016 and then again in 2017. We'll be doing that annually. Now, the reason we keep going and going and going on about the same point is that, to answer your question, not a lot has happened. Between 2007 and 2013, in fact, the Labor Party reduced the size of the diplomatic network and closed posts. It was exactly the opposite of what we were asking them to do. And as I said, the coalition government has actually made an effort to expand the diplomatic network. The worrying thing is that even though we've added 8 posts, we have not substantially increased the number of diplomats overseas, and we're still less than we were 30 years ago. And also we have a significant number of very small posts. Some of those posts are so small, you know, between 1 and 3 diplomats, actually sort of Australia-based diplomats, so that the only thing they can really do is perform the ceremonies, put the flag up and down, and when they go on leave, the door has to be shut and the embassy or the consulate is closed. So like the Canadians, and we were very grateful for the assistance of the Canadian DFAT, it then was, in providing data for that comparative study, because that was very important to compare ourselves with like-minded nations, including Canada, United Kingdom, Netherlands and others similar to us. This is a problem that afflicts most of the developed world. We're not alone in the inattention given to diplomacy. I'm not quite sure how you solve it other than to keep banging on about it. And it did seem to make a difference. The foreign minister, when she announced the 5 new posts back in their first budget in 2014, actually cited our study and said, you know, we take note of the Lowy Institute's call for us to grow our diplomatic network. We know it's too small, and so we're going to do something about it. And so we hope that the Labor Party, if there is a Labor government at this election, we hope it will do the same thing.
Sam. Oh, sorry, Anne-Marie.
Can I just add something about the opening of diplomatic posts? As part of the Pacific pivot that was announced by Prime Minister Morrison last November, they've announced 5 new diplomatic posts in the Pacific. And here's where you actually have to look at the relevance or the quality or the quantity of those posts. To have a post open in Niue, which has population higher in New Zealand than it does in Niue.
1,600 people.
Well, that's an increase of what it was. So you've got to ask the question, you know, let's be constructive about the sort of posts that you're actually opening. It looks good with statistics, but peel back the statistics and it's not that good. I don't want to comment on the other 4 posts. A couple of them are certainly worthwhile, but others are still the same sort of question mark.
All right, and Sam, very quickly, if you don't mind, on future-proofing.
Yeah, look, the great advantage of submarines is stealth. Submarines are relatively small, the oceans are vast, and the submarines can move about pretty much at will. They're extremely difficult to find, or more to the point, they're extremely expensive to find. So if you do want to find enemy submarines, you've got to spend an awful lot of money and throw an awful lot of resources at the problem. I think what the question gets at is that there could be some kind of breakthrough technology in the near future where all of a sudden it becomes much easier and much cheaper to find submarines. there are indications that there's a lot of research going on, but clearly our Defence Department has made the judgment and our ministers have made the judgment that that is not so close to maturity that it should stop us from investing in submarines anyway. That said, there are the Australian Defence Force generally has a pretty good record of being at the cutting edge technologically. And just a few months ago, we had the Minister, Christopher Pyne, announcing that Australia would lead an effort with Boeing to develop a new unmanned combat air vehicle. So, Australia is fairly progressive in that sense, but clearly the judgment has been made that the breakthrough that would make submarines obsolete is not around the corner.
One sense on climate change, obviously it's an issue. If Labor wins, they'll re-engage on that issue internationally. That will be helpful for our relations with China. In other words, give us something to talk about and will be helpful for us in the Pacific.
Very good. I was hoping to come back to these questions, but I can't because I want to ask one final question, and that is by way of advertising, actually. Sam Roggeveen is at the moment writing a new Lowy Institute paper. The next LIP will be by Richard McGregor on the backlash against Xi Jinping, but the one after that will be by Sam, and he's writing on changes in Western politics and what it might mean for Australia's role in the world. So, Sam, I'm going to give you 1 minute to go back to the beginning of our discussion and to think about this election. Is it providing data so far that supports the argument you're trying to make?
Well, if it isn't, then I'll ignore it. I stick to the data that supports my thesis. Look, what I've seen in the first 3 weeks of this election campaign is two parties that are absolutely exhausted. Ten years, I think morally, politically, intellectually exhausted from 10 years of political infighting. It has been the most extraordinary period the last 10 years, as we've not just the prime ministerial turnover, but the viciousness of the infighting, the volatility of the electorate. And most of all, what I would say is the continued, and this is really a 30-year trend now, the continued movement away from the two major parties in the electorate. So at the 2016 election, 25% of the primary votes went to minor parties and independents. This is the big Western trend that Michael alludes to that I'm going to be talking about in my paper. And so far, the opinion polling from this election suggests the trend is going to continue. The two big major parties are both in long-term systematic decline, and that has major implications not only for our domestic politics, and we've already seen the kind of havoc it can cause over the last 10 years, but I think down the line we'll have major implications for Australia's place in the world as well, and that's what my book is going to be talking about.
There you go. Ladies and gentlemen, I hope you've enjoyed that conversation. Thank you for coming. Thank you to all the four panellists for putting on a great show. Given the amount of political churn in the system, we are hoping that we don't have to put on another election panel for at least another 2 or 3 years. But ladies and gentlemen, thank you for coming. As I mentioned, tomorrow I'll be hosting Senator Wong on this stage. I know some of you were lucky enough to get tickets. They sold out pretty quickly. If you don't have a ticket, we'll be publishing the audio and the video shortly after the event. So thank you for coming and enjoy your democracy sausages on the 18th.